when disaster strikes. Will you be ready?
Good evening, and we begin tonight with the monster hurricane and its deadly impact already.
When all hope is gone, will the government be there for you? If you're looking for ways to take your prepping to the next level, then you've come to the right place. Broadcasting from a secure and well-prepared location, it's time for Prepping 2.0. And now, please welcome authors Glenn Tate and Shelby Gallagher.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to this week's episode of Prepping 2.0. We'll be talking about a 51st state, a 52nd state, a 53rd state. And in the second part of our show, we're going to have with us someone you may or may not be aware of, but we're going to introduce you to her. Her name is Lady Liberty, and she is part of the 51st state movement. So before we get into that, though, let's give you a quick introduction. This is Prepping 2.0. Encourage you to go to our website at prepping2-0, and you can listen to previous episodes there. You can also rate, subscribe, comment, review on many of the different platforms that you can listen to us. There's all the ways through podcast mediums. There's also, we are on regular radio stations. We are on KYAH out of Utah. Hello, Utah. We are on a couple of stations out of Salem, Oregon, KSLM and KYKN, a couple of others, and too numerous to name, but encourage you to go to those, your favorite places, whatever it are. Rate, subscribe, upload, click 5 stars. All of that just helps the algorithms, helps us to grow our show. And on that note, I should probably tell you who else is on the show with us today, who the other part of us is. With me is my co-host, my husband, and fellow author, Glenn Tate. Hello, Glenn.
Hello, hello, Shelby. Yes, it's all about the algorithms. The algorithms run our lives. And if you get in good with the algorithms, you're golden.
You're good.
And then they tell other people, they suggest, hey, you might want to listen to this. And of course, we know, Shelby, that once somebody listens to this show, hooked for life.
Why
they're probably
would you,
getting
why
tattoos.
Why would you go anywhere else?
They're probably getting tattoos that say, like, Prepping 2.0 is probably
exactly.
The next step.
If somebody wants to send us that picture when they get that done, please do.
We'll give you a free t-shirt if you get a tattoo.
Exactly. Oh, my goodness.
It's not asking much on
no,
our part.
No, it isn't. Just a permanent marking on their body for the rest of their lives. That's awesome. So one of the things we do on Prepping 2.0, and you can see this at the website, is we're going through this list of the top 100 things that will disappear in a collapse or become incredibly scarce. I'm going to let, I'm going to let Glenn take this. And you need to know, Glenn does voices. He has a lot of fun doing voices. So for those of you who might recognize this voice, but I'm going to let him take number 14. Take it away, Glenn.
Number 14 is propane and propane accessories.
That was Hank Hill. I love doing Hank Hill. He's my hero.
And who's Hank Hill for those of us who are under 25?
Wow. that's not you.
Nope.
Hank Hill, there was a cartoon, King of the Hill, and it was a Mike Judge thing. He did Beavis and Butthead, and he did Idiocracy, both of which have a lot of really good social commentary in them, and it's not just, you know, silly entertainment. It's that, too. And King of the Hill is hilarious, and Hank Hill,
the main character,
he sells propane and propane accessories, and if you've seen the show right now, you're saying, Glenn, you're probably the greatest impersonationist. I just made up a
impressionist.
I'm an author. I communicate for a living. Poorly, apparently. So anyway, that's it. Propane heaters. That's a thing. You got to have propane heaters. This makes a lot of sense. Electricity probably out. Fuel, firewood. You know, we have stories about people in Bosnia breaking up pianos and things and trying furniture and things, trying to burn it. And then, you know, little propane canisters, the 1 pound canisters that are very easy to find. They're cheap. Get them on sale, by the way. I've seen them go for between $10 and $1, right? I mean, a huge swing, and get a big sale on them. Little lanterns. Coleman have the nice the lanterns, and they're also a little bit of a heater too. There are all kinds of stoves that work on propane. Obviously, if you're in an enclosed space and you're running a propane heater, you got carbon monoxide to think about, so consider that. But you can cook on them, you can boil water, heat, light, very, very versatile. By the way, there's a little adapter thing you can get on Amazon that allows you to fill up those little 1 pound little green Coleman propane canisters from like a barbecue sized canister. And that's a pretty handy thing. That way you can keep using your small propane accessories with commonly available barbecue size or larger propane tanks. So, and this list comes from people that have been through things like Bosnia and Venezuela and Argentina and those sorts of things. And they've said, yep, here are the things that go first. So that's why we talk about them, because they're things people should probably consider.
And let me just throw this in here too. And this is something that I think it's worth sharing. And if those of you who know me know that I was a country girl living in the city for way too long, lived in the city for a long time. Now I live in the country. Here's the, what is so cool about propane compared to gasoline? And this is your answer. And I knew this, but it's very practical now living in the country. Gasoline is unstable. It will eventually go bad. And a lot of times you can put preservatives and things like that, but it goes bad. Propane does not. And you and I have had a learning curve on that. The other thing is that, especially out in the country where electrical lines aren't as prevalent as they are in the city, people use propane a heck of a lot more than they do in the city. And I know for those of you who are listening going, you're saying to me, well, no kidding, Shelby, we know that. Well, if you live in the city, you don't. And if you live in the city, it's good to have those little propane tanks so that you can run a stove, you can have some heat, you can have some sort of extra backup to your electricity that will go down in a collapse or in a grid down sort of situation. Do you have any thoughts on that, Glenn?
No, well said. Propane is a big deal. All silly impersonations aside, it is something to really think about. There are tons of devices, like I said, lanterns and stoves that run on propane, and all you need to do is get some of them and get some propane, and you don't have to worry about switching it out every year or anything like that, like with gasoline.
And be super safe. Seriously, there's a lot of things that, you know, on like say a ladder, don't climb to the and stand on the top of the ladder. All the warnings that are on propane tanks, heed them. It's a big deal. Okay, so the next thing we want to talk about, and again, the topic today is a 51st state, a 52nd state. We'll get a little bit more into that when Lady Liberty comes on with us. But this is what I wanted to really talk about, and Glenn's going to help me out here. As conservatives, as people who have lived many through a couple of, you know, decades of elections coming and going and different administrations, the one thing that I think we can really agree on is elections don't seem to work. And we're going to talk about why that is. And that, as we look at 2020 coming, that's something to really consider, because the come away from this conversation, I hope you have it, you can see where my perspective is. They don't work, and it is a corrupt system. It used to not be. It used to be minimal corruption. There used to be an effort to keep it from being corrupt. No longer. Now it's like, how much more corrupt can it become? So you have an experience, though, and a good example regarding gerrymandering and elections.
Yeah, absolutely. And by the way, I completely agree that by and large, elections don't seem to work. There are a couple isolated, you know, exceptions to that. There might be a really close initiative in your state about, you know, a new gun control measure that's on the ballot. So sometimes it makes sense to vote. We're not like saying never vote, but right. By and large, I think a lot of people are thinking it doesn't seem to work.
Well, let me jump in here. Yes. I remember talking to you in 2016, and your position was, I am shocked that Trump won because of the cheating. So, right.
Exactly. And we'll get into election fraud, in a moment, but that's one of the reasons I kind of quit voting until about 2016 was, you know, why? It doesn't matter. The D's are going to cheat. And part of that's based on firsthand knowledge I have about election fraud. But first, we really want to talk about gerrymandering. And this is not some big political discussion. We're just going to talk about what it is and what it isn't. I am firmly convinced. Oh, I should pause for a moment. I have a background in the political world. I've seen stuff up close. I hate to say this, I know what I'm talking about. It's not like I watched this on TV. I've seen this. So gerrymandering is where, for state legislative districts or federal U.S. House districts, the boundaries get to be determined by politicians. Well, it's very easy to draw the lines so that a district is pretty safely about 55% for one party, Democrats usually, and about 45%. And so what you can do, you can have, you know, 55% of your voters in a suburb or an urban setting, and then like 45% out in the country. And that seat, even though it looks like it covers all kinds of ground, it actually really means that that seat is always going to be Democrat or in some cases Republican, but it's always going to be held by one party. There's math, there's algorithms, there's geography and equations that will tell you this. You know, down to the precinct level and even the household level, who's going to vote how. And you can have computers that figure out, how do I have a district? Show me the boundaries of a district that would be 55% Democrat and 45% Republican. And the computer will say, how many different choices do you want? There are variations. The reason I bring this up is when I was involved in politics, not as an elected person, because please, that would make me throw up. I mean, I couldn't do that. It's gross and disgusting. But say an advisory role, observer maybe. I remember that the Washington State Republican Party, I was at an event, and they gave an award to a Republican who did the most for the Republican Party that year. And by the way, the guy, I won't say who it was, he's a good guy, by the way. He's a decent human being. I actually know him, and he's a good guy. The reason he got the award for helping out the Republican Party the most, whatever given year that was that he was on the districting commission of the state legislature. So he was the Republican representative that figured out what the boundaries would be. And in the state of his speech, he might have had a couple pops, a couple drinks or something. He was pretty clear. He said, yeah, well, we're going to keep a bunch of our seats, and the D's are going to have a bunch of their seats, and there's a couple little swing districts that maybe we can fight over. But he was basically, and I'm not kidding, this sounds like an exaggeration, he was being rewarded and recognized for keeping Republican districts Republican. And he gave up all attempt at fighting to have fair districts in which maybe Republicans could win some of these seats. In other words, he was fine with and was being rewarded for keeping districts Republican. And then the D's got their thing, and they got to run the legislature, and shrug, that's just the way it is. Gerrymandering, folks, is the explanation for so much of politics. How many times have you out there, the listener, said to yourself, hey, me and everybody I know, you know, vote for conservatives. We turn out to vote. We do all this stuff. Maybe you even live in a conservative state. I mean, folks in Utah, for example, listening to us on terrestrial radio, you're saying to yourself, geez, you know, we're all conservatives and we vote this way. How come, you know, some Democrats keep winning? The answer is gerrymandering. Yes, you vote, but you guys are the 45% who never seem to get an election to go your way. And what does this cause? This causes people like us conservatives, the 45% in this example, to say, huh, every single time me and all my friends go out and vote, we always seem to lose. Now, that's more true in you know, very liberal states like we're in Washington State than it is, you know, I don't think this is a problem in Alabama or, you know, someplace like that. But in a lot of places where there's even a remote amount of swing districts or swing population, Republicans always seem to lose despite being roughly, it varies, roughly 50% of the voters seem to get like 20% of the wins. I'm making these numbers up, but it illustrates it. It's because of gerrymandering. When the history of the FUSA, the former United States of America, is written, gerrymandering is going to have a paragraph or two about how gerrymandering caused this, and the left loves it, and it makes us say elections don't seem to work. And Shelby, what's another reason that we as conservatives, especially in rural areas, seem to think like our vote doesn't count anymore?
Honestly, because it doesn't. And I absolutely agree with that mentality. And again, I say it as a person who's a conservative living in one of those urban environments. And for those who live in rural environments, let me tell you what it's like. If you live in the city, you are looking at your ballot going, I have choices between, when I look at like city council members.
Left and left.
Left and more left. So I don't even have any choices. But when you're talking about your house districts, state house districts, it gets really tricky in terms of that, because you're hoping that your one guy from hopefully your community will be the conservative, but the problem is he or she is going to go to the state house, and they are overrun. This happens in Oregon. I'm speaking for Oregon, and it's happening here in Washington. They're going to go to the Capitol, and they're overrun. They're outvoted. They're there to create quorum. That is all. And here's a really good example. The gerrymandering happens often in Oregon, and let me give you the key that's coming up with that for those of you who are in Oregon, and those of you in other states, pay attention to this. In the state of Oregon, they rewrite those house districts, and it's in the house where it's based upon location, every 10 years. Every 10 years, the Secretary of State of Oregon goes through this big, long process. Either they take the recommendations from the legislature or they rewrite districts. That was done in 2010 by, shockingly, now Governor Kate Brown, who was the Secretary of State at the time. So there were some gerrymandered districts in 2010. How gerrymandered? If you look at Bend, Oregon, look at the House districts. There is literally a district that looks like a donut. It's called the donut because they did exactly what you said. We want to make sure that stays mixed enough so that it's to our advantage. And as a result, that House district has now gone liberal instead of conservative. Now what's happened, and pay attention to this, in Oregon, it's one of your last straws of hope, if there's any hope at all. The Secretary of State that was just voted into office in 2016, Dennis Richardson, he's a conservative. It was shocking, along with when he won, if you were in Oregonian, you're like, oh my gosh, there's a Republican at a statewide office. Wow, wow, and we have Trump. I mean, there was a little straw of hope with that. He recently passed away. So now the governor is going to, Governor Kate Brown, who is far left liberal, needs to appoint somebody. It has to be Dennis Richardson was a Republican, so she has to appoint a Republican, but there's a lot of squishy Republicans in Oregon, and guess who's going to redo those lines come 2020? The person that she appoints, and you better be darn tuned, she's going to have a long conversation with that person before they're appointed about how House districts will remain liberal in Oregon, and that's tragic. I know one of the things that Dennis Richardson campaigned on was to keep that whole gerrymandering, that whole redistricting that must happen in Oregon every 10 years, keep it fair. That is now gone with his passing, and it's very sad. So these are important. These are very important issues, and it's not just on your state level. We'll talk a little bit with what little time we have left in this, how it happens on a congressional level too.
Well, yeah, it's basically the same thing we were talking about at the congressional level, and it's the 55 and 45% things. By the way, did you ever wonder to yourself, why is it that the U.S. Senate seems to be a lot more conservative than the House? And the reason is you can't gerrymander a state. Take the state of Colorado, for example. You vote for a senator throughout the whole state. What they can't do is divide up the state into little districts like they can with the House. And then those little districts have the donut and they have the 55-45 stuff. So you're gonna find the US Senate statewide, because you can't gerrymander a state, which we're going to talk about a little bit, not specifically, but when Lady Liberty talks, we're going to talk about how an urban core controls a whole state, and that's why Eastern Washington wants to split off and become a 51st state, the state of liberty, and all of that. Yes, ma'am.
So let me just speak to that. Again, I know I come at this from as a person who's lived in Oregon, but I encourage you, use it as an example to go, put on your political grid glasses and look at your state. If you look at the state of Oregon and the congressional House district seats, it's a pretty square state. And out of Portland, Oregon, which is the liberal hub of the state.
Socialist, really.
And really, it really is about three, precincts in the Portland, Oregon area that controls the voting of the entire state. They're very high density, hardcore liberal left, and they're right around downtown Portland, so it's crazy. The House districts, if you look at how they're formed and the geography of them, they have fingers that come all the way from Eastern Oregon and draw a finger of the population out of Portland. And if you look at other states that have the same sort of problem with that, you're going to see that in your House district races, because that's gerrymandering. That's making it so that you can pull that 55% out. And it's ridiculous. It is ridiculous. So that's why the person in Eastern Washington, the person in Eastern Oregon, they're like, I don't have any representation. I've got this crazy left-leaning, hardcore progressive representing me, and I'm out here just trying to grow my crops.
Well, and yes, and that's the gerrymandering part. The other part is just the sheer numbers. Take a state like, there's a lot of examples. Colorado, where you've got Denver. The just sheer numbers, Denver is going to determine the fate of rural Coloradans. There are all kinds of other examples. We always focus on the West.
Yeah.
Try New York.
Oh, for New York Upstate State, New York.
Upstate New York. Yes. You guys, and I know we got listeners there, you guys are far more conservative than New York City, which isn't saying much, but still, there's all kinds of that. Look at the panhandle of Florida.
Absolutely.
Look at, I don't know,
Maryland.
The panhandle
of Texas.
Yeah, the panhandle of Maryland. Western Maryland is very conservative. Maryland Tucky, as they call it. And this happens all over the place where you've got the urban core, just sheer numbers, overrunning the rest of a state. And then you have, for example, in Washington State recently, very strict gun control, which was a shocker to me, to be quite honest. We have some pretty, up until now, pretty good gun laws. We had pretty good voters. One election, a bunch of people probably moved from, you know, California or North Korea or wherever the heck they came with their silly ideas. And they just overran us. And now if you're an extremely rural, Western, Eastern Washington, Western kind of person. I know guys who are cattle ranchers, like ride on horses and round up the dogies. I mean, real live ranchers and cowboys who now are subject to extreme left-wing Seattle laws. And what does this lead to? It leads to those rural areas, those conservative areas saying, we're getting ripped off. Our
yes.
voice is not heard.
This is no longer a democracy.
This is no longer a republic or anything else. I know what you mean. It's like, hey, why even vote? And then you get Eastern Washington, perhaps Northern New York, perhaps Northern California, the state of Jefferson. There are all these movements out there to split up a state, to make them smaller, to make them better grouped, so that if you are a conservative in, let's say, the mountainous part of Colorado, that your vote doesn't get canceled out by, you know, 9 or 10 people in Denver who, you know, are a bunch of, I don't know, dependent, you know, Democrat-leaning kind of people who just want free stuff or whatever. So now you can actually have, you know, a voice. And here's the thing, important thing to remember. The movement to split up states is not secession. It is not a civil war. It is not violent. It is using the process that is in every state constitution and is in the United States Constitution. I won't go over all the clauses and article numbers, but trust me, it's happened a bunch of times. Virginia split up into West Virginia. Massachusetts split up into, off the top of my head, New Hampshire and also Maine. States are split up. I mean, I'm not going to say all the time, but it is a thing. Just because you haven't seen in your lifetime doesn't mean it isn't possible. So this is the peaceful, lawful, constitutional way for people to say, this isn't working for us. We'd like to have our own state. And that's what I love about the Liberty State movement and all the other state splitting movements, is that nobody gets hurt. It's completely lawful. All it takes is a vote from that state's legislature, and Congress has to approve of it. And I think we're going to see more and more of this, hence the title of this, 51st State, 52nd State, 53rd. 15 seconds. Take us out, Shelby.
Yeah, looking forward to hearing Lady Liberty's talk to us about this on the other side of the break, so don't go away.
We'll be right back with more of Prepping 2.0 with authors Shelby Gallagher and Glenn Tate right after this.
The Operator G1 is a full-featured, rugged comm solution designed for the Midland MX-T100 and 105. Designed and manufactured in the USA, the Operator is an all-in-one support platform for two-way wireless communication for civilians. Using the GMRS bands, there is no ham license required and no test needed for operation. Ideal for preppers, hunters, homesteaders, ranchers, and people just like you. Waterproof when closed, this rugged system houses the Midland radio, microphone, and antenna, providing an always-ready, always-charged grab-and-go solution for emergencies or events, as well as an ideal solution for a base station or vehicle use. Powered by a 60Ah internal battery, the Operator recharges quickly and easily using the supplied AC charger, the internal solar controller, or directly from a vehicle. If you recognize the value of wireless communication with or without grid power, the Operator G1 is an award-winning solution that allows simple, one-button communication when it counts. Our 2-year warranty, quality materials, and first-class assembly technicians deliver a high-value solution when you need to be sure you can get your comms up. To learn more, go online to PortableUniversalPower.com.
PrepperNet, where preppers unite. Looking to meet other like-minded people in your area? Looking to start your own prepper group? Already have a group? Join PrepperNet.com. PrepperNet has gathered the biggest names in the industry to help unite preppers everywhere. Join John Jacob Schmidt, Scott Hunt, Dr. Bones and Nurse Amy, Glenn Tate, Shelby Gallagher, Charlie Hogwood, Samuel Culper, Survivor Jane, Rick Austin, Franklin Horton, Ryan Mitchell, and Brian Duff. Our team is united. Check us out at PrepperNet.com. PrepperNet, where preppers unite. PrepperNet.com.
And we're back with more of Prepping 2.0 with authors Glenn Tate and Shelby Gallagher.
Welcome back, everyone. This is Shelby Gallagher. Excited to have with us for the second half of our show, Lady Liberty. And for those of us who are basically not in Eastern Washington, Lady Liberty represents the 51st State Movement. And that's starting to get finally some really good traction and some really good feet on it, which is great. So welcome, Lady Liberty.
Thank you for having me. This is a great opportunity to kind of give a voice to what's going on to the West Side.
Yes, very good. Good. So, first of all, what I'd like to do is ask, when we say the 51st state in the state of Washington, what does that mean?
Okay, so the 51st state is, we're referring to dividing the state of Washington, where that will benefit Eastern Washingtonians, where all of the Eastern Washingtonians are more or less having all their votes flushed down the toilet by a few counties on the west side of the state, every single vote. And so what we're looking to do is more or less restore the power of the vote, get our representation back by dividing the state. And so that's what this whole effort is about, is more or less restoring the power of our vote.
And by dividing the state, do you mean with guns and stuff, or do you mean like having two states, having Congress recognize that there's the state of Washington and the state of Liberty?
Well, okay, so the Constitution actually reads in Article 4, Section 3, that you can legally divide the state with a simple majority vote in the legislature. And once you've achieved that, which is actually super beneficial to our side, because it's not even a two-thirds vote required, it's just a simple majority. So that's a huge plus, meaning that that law was written in a way that lets it be done, that makes it doable. And so we're following that, and once the legislature is able to get that passed, then we approach Congress, who would be approving or disapproving of it. And we see the current era of what's going on in Congress as very promising to our movement, because they're looking to adopt possibly as many as 3 new states, with Puerto Rico, Guam, and even the Marianas Islands. And so we see that as a huge benefit to the Liberty State effort, because if they even adopt one more state, then that would throw off the balance in the Senate, and then they would be needing another state to come in and restore that balance in the Senate. So the fact that they're currently even looking at Puerto Rico is a huge step in the right direction for our effort. So, yeah.
Very cool. So this isn't a brand new idea that just sprung up this legislative session. So Lady Liberty, and we obviously, folks who are listening, this is not your real name, but that's okay. We're going to call you Lady Liberty for today. Tell us what brought you to this. What made you so passionate about this? Give us a little bit of your background.
Well, okay. So for the past 13 years, I've been involved in quite a few different efforts, largely to do with property rights, water rights, kind of what I'm seeing as being Mussolini's definition of the perfect working fascist order, which is the cooperation between corporations and the government to work in tandem against the people. And that is Mussolini's definition of the perfect working fascist system, which today is called public-private partnerships. They've renamed it so that it's kind of flying under the radar and nobody's recognizing what's really happening. And so that all started back in 2006. I have an awful lot to do with livestock and ag, and so I watched a lot of those fascist principles start to creep in with National Animal Identification System. That was absolutely a fascist thing that started in Washington. And so I've been heavily involved in leading quite a few of those movements, and being a leader of a property rights group for the past 5 years now. And what we continually found was that because of all the regulations from like Department of Ecology and just regulations period, the little guy always loses, you know? And I just, you know, if anybody could put up a fight, a solid fight, we did. And I have, across several different efforts, and it is right next to impossible to ever be the winner in this kind of a system. And so that kind of puts everybody, you know, it forces you into a corner where you're making choices to save your business, your farm, that you shouldn't be, you know, forced into making. And so when this effort started to divide the state, where the result would mean that we actually get rid of these regulations, you know, as the state is brought in anew, we aren't going to have those regulations. We're not going to have Growth Management Act that is prohibiting businesses and stopping agriculture and stopping mining. And this actually restores our power of our vote. It keeps us from losing our livelihoods, losing our livestock. And a lot of these regulations has an awful lot to do with the control of the food supply, you know, and the diminishment of our means to provide our own food, you know, the raising of livestock. And so this effort cuts out all of that in one fell swoop, where we've done nothing but bang our heads against the wall in futile efforts just that take up all your time and all your money to fight these things, and you still lose in the end. Well, this is the only effort that actually circumnavigates all of this stuff. It cuts them all off at the pass because it gets rid of it right from the get-go. We're not even going to have to deal with that kind of garbage any longer in a new liberty state. And so that, to me, is the only thing that I've seen that could possibly be effective anymore. Because we have tried every single avenue and all of these different property rights issues and water rights issues where we do nothing but lose. And this is the only effort I've seen that can actually produce any kind of success whatsoever. So
what you're talking about, and I think this is the sad truth of rural Americans, and what you're speaking to, just so people know, just to kind of fill in some gaps here, you live in Eastern Washington, and because of the way the legislature is made up and because of the way the crookedness happens in politics and all of that, there's a supermajority in our legislature. So what happens is when there's a vote that regarding property rights, regarding water rights, regarding livestock,
gun control,
all of that, the majority of you're represented, your vote, your identity is defined by downtown Seattle.
Exactly.
So a downtown Seattle legislator or someone who was recruited by a downtown politician to run in Eastern Washington is making decisions for Eastern Washington. And that's not fair, because what happens is your rights, your identity as someone not in downtown Seattle is completely obliterated. This is, I believe, as someone who used to live in Oregon, yes, same thing over there. Eastern Oregonians are tired of their politics and their votes being hammered by people from Portland. So it's the same thing. So I wanted to give that kind of fill that in, because as we listen to the fans that we have, that Glenn and I have, we hear this in other states. I've heard this in New York. People in upstate New York, everyone thinks that everyone in New York must live in New York City, right? Or that sort of a thing. And I think there's a lot of credence to this, and I think it allows everyone to have their own identity. It allows Western Washington, which is dominated by Seattle politics, to have their own identity as kind of the urban, you know, When Harry Met Sally sort of whatever, pie in the sky kind of, but then allows Eastern Washington with its agricultural identity to maintain their identity and regulate and govern accordingly. So that's what's, that's also part of it too, is that it allows you to keep your identity too.
Exactly, yeah, because what we're seeing with the fact that we've lost our power of the vote is exactly what you're saying. The urban is dictating to the rural, when the urban doesn't know anything about what's going on in the rural, and what they do know, they're still trying to figure out. And where the rural residents have known this all along for the past couple hundred years, that's the ag community. Urbanites don't know how to manage cattle. They don't know how to manage land. They don't know how to keep a good water source running. They don't know these things, and yet they're telling us how to do them when they're the least educated in any of it. And so, you know, just, and it goes both ways. I mean, if the rural was suddenly to be in charge of Seattle, would that work out well for people in Seattle? No. You know, so I mean, it's just, it's something that should happen just because it already is a natural divide. There's no reason for one to rule the other. And, you know, and especially when, like, I think a prime example is, I don't know if you ever saw it, but a while back they had a cartoon out called Barnyard. And in this movie, you know, it was a cartoon movie, right? And it was for kids and stuff. But the main character was a cow, right? He was a bull. And yet he was, throughout the movie, he had teats. Like, you know, like a milk cow. And he was a male cow. And I'm like, well,
must be one of those California, like, you know, 19 different gender things.
Yeah, I was like, do they not know? I mean, is this an urban cartoonist drawing a rural setting? And, you know, and this is kind of how we feel in Eastern Washington when Seattle politics are trying to tell us how to run farms, because it makes about as much sense. You know, bulls, you can't milk a bull. Okay, come on.
Exactly.
And so this is how they're portraying farm animals, you know. And so that's kind of my analogy to how they run things too. It's like they have no clue. And so yeah, it's one of those things that just flat out needs to happen, because they just don't know what's going on. And especially like in the water area, we have had so many meetings with Department of Ecology where they come in, and the prime example of them assuming that you're polluting the water if cows can get to the water, right? Like any kind of river, they want to block all that. And the prime example was a cattle farmer named Len McIrvin, who had 3,200 acres that sat along the Colville River, and he had over 2,300 head of cattle. And they had full access to this river, so they could walk in and out of it. They could drink whatever, you know, full access. Well, all this ground looked like it was beautiful. It was pristine, continually green. You could not kill the grass. 2,300 head of cattle, 3,200 acres. Well, DOE said, you're going to have to get all the cattle off of there because you're polluting the water. And so Len McIrvin, he said, well, let's do some testing. And so they tested the water, and he was smart enough to go right along with DOE and take his own test samples where the water came into his property and then where it left his property. So they took two samples. They did these samples twice a year, once in the spring, once in the fall, for 3 years in a row. 3 years consecutively, the water that left his farm, passing 2,300 head of cattle with full access, they could walk into it all the time, left his property 300% cleaner. How do you possibly figure that out? As far as Department of Ecology said, they were ready to take, basically assume, 3,200 acres of this man's land on the presumption that they had to be polluting the water. And yet, every single time they tested the water, it was 300% cleaner when it left. And so, you know, these are the kind of huge, huge mistakes that are happening on a daily basis. And so...
You're being kind. I don't think those are mistakes.
Yes, exactly. So, I mean, yeah, you could get a lot more descriptive than that.
Right. And this is one of many examples where you have, and Glenn and I have talked about it, this weaponizing of government where you just regulate a business owner, a landowner, and pester them with regulation. And like you said earlier, they have to spend their time and their money and their attention just to keep their land, just to keep the things that are near and dear to them. So here's what I think is really cool. We've got some background there. This is getting some legs to it. I'm really excited about this because we've all heard about this. They're splitting off of the state and the dividing of the state. This is definitely getting some legs. There has been a bill presented before the Washington legislature right now in this session. Kind of exciting to think about. So talk to us about that. Where's that at this point?
Okay, right now, Representative Matt Shea has submitted HB 1509 and also HJM 4003. 1509 would divide the state as well as establish transition groups to manage, you know, the changeover. And then HJM 4003 addresses Congress and the President of the United States about the division of the state as well. And so so both of those bills have had a public reading, and we just recently submitted a formal request for formal hearing on those as well. And so hopefully that will happen very soon. We've got another week. And so I'm going to try to put the pressure on this week and get that accomplished. And so those are the two bills we have right now.
Well, I'm kind of a political guy in the sense of I understand politics, and I used to participate in it in the Washington State Legislature, and I've lived in Olympia and Seattle, and so I understand the Seattle mindset. So with that background, here's my question. Here's a statement first. I know that a lot of the people in Seattle, the liberals, and they're pretty much all liberal, they think Eastern Washington, you guys are a bunch of hicks and all that other stuff. And you can just imagine they look down on you and sort of pity you and all of that. If Eastern Washington is such a basket case of badness, like the liberals think, and the liberals also think that Eastern Washington gets all this free stuff from the state of Washington, like highway funds and everything else. If Eastern Washington is such a drain on Western Washington, why wouldn't the Western Washingtonians who control the legislature say adios? Because there's a phrase that Southerners have, and I love it. And after the first Civil War, the Southern phrase is, well, if the South's so bad, why'd you want it back?
Right.
And if Eastern Washington is so terrible, why don't these bills pass unanimously? I mean, hey, Seattle, why can't you just let Eastern Washington be on its own if they're a bunch of hicks? We all know the answer, but I'm curious what your take is.
Well, I feel like it would work for both sides equally as well. I mean, there's no reason not to. It works very well for them if they would decide to divide the state as well. Because, I mean, my goodness, they wouldn't have so much opposition to everything. They would actually be getting rid of us. You know what I mean? They could have everything they ever wanted if they would just let us go. You know, both sides would be happy. I mean, it's kind of like a bad marriage, really. I mean, if you have two people that are absolutely diametrically opposed in every possible way, they're better off alone. They're both happier doing their own thing, getting what each side wants. And the same is true here. The rural people want rural type things that they've voted for the past 20 years and haven't been able to get them. And the West Side wouldn't have to face the constant ongoing opposition. It just works. It just works for both sides.
So really cool thing, we were talking about this before we got started here. This is nothing new. This is actually an idea that's going on in other places around the country. And And what people need to realize, I think we talked about in the beginning, is that because if you just add one state like this, when you split off the Liberty State from Washington State, and you add one state, there will be an apoplectic, losing their mind response from Congress because it throws off the balance of power. I've talked to Glenn about this. This is why Hawaii and Alaska became states very quickly, right next to each other, because you needed them to happen in even numbers. So what are some other places around our country where this movement is getting some legs under it?
Well, okay, so I would have to say, well, California, with their effort in Jefferson, that would be the first most obvious one. But really, this is kind of happening in every state across the United States right now, because what we're seeing is the majority coming out in all the urban centers and them dominating all the rural areas, and it just doesn't work. It just flat out doesn't work. And so we're kind of seeing an awful lot of interest in what's happening with our Liberty State effort just for that reason alone. There, it's duplicated across the United States. You know, this is a current problem. So, yeah, and as far as being able to bring it in as having two states at a time, even if we didn't adopt Puerto Rico, which they're trying so hard to do right now, even if we didn't do that, gosh, even if it was Washington and then California, you know, they both could be accepted at the same time. So
absolutely, you know. And like you said, this is the presidential time to do it. There's enough of a like-mindedness in our current Congress that you would hope in all of this they could at least get that done if we got to that point. So
right, absolutely.
So cool is that. So we
and even more exciting, another group of the Republicans in the Washington State Legislature also just put forward a bill to address to Congress to adopt Puerto Rico. So that also assists the Liberty State effort as well.
Very cool. So for those who are listening and you're in other states, I hear you. You've sent me the emails where it's like, that's just like here in Kentucky. That's just like here. So many states are doing this and looking at this and taking this a little bit more seriously, which I think is exciting. So what I think is also really cool, and this is just kind of fun stuff, libertystate.org, where if people are like interested in how this is all working out and what it looks like, this isn't just an idea on a post-it note. You, the Liberty State, the movement behind it, you guys have a flag. What do you have? And people can find out at the website. So tell us about that.
Okay. So yeah, that's very exciting. This effort has been going on for about 2 years now. We're nearly finished with our Liberty State Constitution. That has been an absolutely mind-blowing process. And that Constitution is looking phenomenal right now. So exciting. We've taken a vote for everything that is Liberty State so far. We've had a vote to decide the flag that we have, a vote to decide the state animal, which is now the cougar. Our current vote is for the state rifle. You know, what are we going to choose for
so
the
cool.
state rifle?
So
you know,
cool.
I know. And it just doesn't stop there. I mean, it's endlessly cool. We've had several different votes for we've got the state seal chosen. Gosh, it's been awesome, the input on all of it. If you go to the website, we've got a page where you can buy the flag, where you can buy T-shirts, bumper stickers, you name it. We've sold over 250 flags so far, and they're flying everywhere. We've seen them, on the front of businesses, flying in the back of people's trucks, you know, hanging on people's yard fences because they don't have a flagpole, you know, and so it just kind of all over. We've had some real excitement come out of it, and that Liberty State website is something everybody needs to take a look at.
Very cool. So one thing I will say this, we live in Western Washington, Glenn and I do, we've joked about it, but whenever we go to the east side, which is often, a couple times a year maybe, we see the flag. And this is not an odd topic. It is, if you go to Eastern Washington, people know what you're talking about. You talk about the Liberty State and they get excited about it. And so if somebody wants to check it out, if they need to contact you or want more information, where would they go?
Yeah, they need to go to libertystate.org And there's if you hit the links there, you can send them an email. If you're in one of the counties that would be Liberty State, tell them what county you're in, and they can hook you up with a volunteer group that is organized, structured, organized volunteer groups in nearly every single county so far in Eastern Washington. So, yeah, absolutely. That's where they need to go and check it out and volunteer.
Oh, very good. And I would say, too, check out, if you're listening and you're very interested in this, you live in Washington, check out what county you're in. Check out who your representative is and let them know. Send them a quick email and let them know your thoughts on the bill that's going, the two bills going through. That's huge right there. Find out who your representative is. They need to hear from you on this. So I will say this. We only have a couple moments left. I always like to leave people with our favorite quote, and that is from Benjamin Franklin. Failing to prepare is preparing to fail. I wish all of you a great week. Take care, everyone.
You've been listening to Prepping 2.0 with authors Shelby Gallagher and Glenn Tate. All of the fun and easy prepping information heard on this podcast can be found online at prepping2-0.com. You can also find out more about Glenn's books online at 299days.com and about Shelby's books online at agreatstate.com. Until next time, be smart, be safe, and be prepared.